This is Peter Ford. I was for over 30 years in the British diplomatic service. I ended up being ambassador first in Bahrain and then Syria before I had a second career in the United Nations. More recently with the Workers' Party of George Galloway. But Bahrain has been in the news this week because it has been the target of some very interesting uranium attacks, specifically an attack on an Amazon data center. Now, why would the Iranians have chosen this target? Well, in the first place, because Bahrain itself is the number one enemy in the Gulf of Iran. It's the or has been the headquarters of the American Fifth Fleet for many years. I don't know if it still is because the American base has been battered and is probably only semi-functional. And it's been the main enemy of Iran because of the demographics. Bahrain alone among the Gulf principalities is majority Shia, the same denomination of Islam as the Iranians. It's about 60 or 70% Shia, but the ruling family, who were brought in decades ago by the British from Kuwait, are Sunni. And they are dictators to all intents and purposes, propped up by the Western powers. As occasion has required, they've sometimes been kept in power also by Saudi military might. The Saudis intervened a decade ago when the Arab Spring was kicking off and the Shia people were rebelling. So Bahrain has been in the forefront of the US plan to do down Iran for many, many years. The Iranians have absolutely no compunction about hitting Bahrain hard, while they do have some compunction about hitting places like Saudi Arabia and Oman, which have been a bit more calibrated in their responses. And why this database? Well, firstly, because it's billions of dollars of American investment. It appears to be one of these newfangled mega data centers for Amazon. America will be feeling the pain. The investment is going up literally in smoke. And it's Iran's tit for tat response to American attacks on their own economic infrastructure. The Americans have been bombing bridges and other Iranian facilities, non-military. And so the Iranians, who are very scrupulous in carrying out what they say, and they've said, you hit us in a civilian target, and we will reciprocate. And that's exactly what they have done, only harder than the Americans, probably in economic cost, much, much harder. So the Donald has to put that in his pipe and smoke it. That's what's going on here.
I noticed the Amazon data center that has been, at least by apparently, looks like almost destroyed in this Iranian attack. It's right out in the desert, and you can see actually in the photos the city of Bahrain in the distance. So it does make you wonder that maybe they put it out there in the desert for a reason, that they knew that it might be attacked.
Well, the Iranians are keeping some of their cards still close to their chest, but let's not forget they are still pulling their punches. They could take out the Bahrain royal family in its palaces. This would be like the last thing. It would be if Iranians felt really threatened, they could take out several of the ruling Gulf families. And this threat is being brandished in the background. And this is why the Gulf countries have been hedging their bets in some cases. But Bahrain, for the reason I explained, is more afraid of its own people than it is of Iran itself. And therefore they continue to cling to their American savior.
Now, like Israel and so much in the Gulf region, this Bahrain is a country which has really been set up by the British. Can you tell us a little bit about its history and maybe about what it's like as a place when you were ambassador there?
There's a big British expatriate community, and it not that long ago, just a couple of days ago, British officials held important positions in the Bahrain security forces, particularly a police force that was accused of torture. Until a couple of decades ago, Bahrain was effectively a protectorate, and the number one protectors were the British. In recent decades, the Americans virtually taken over. But it was effectively, as I explained earlier, the British who brought in the rulers. They owe their positions to the British. They're very anglicized. They went to British schools and universities. Some of them married British wives. But in recent years, they've become more and more Americanized, and the younger generation of the princes are more Americanized.
I mean, it's obviously hot down there. What's it like living there day to day?
Yeah, well, there are three seasons in Bahrain: hot, hotter, and hottest. It's very humid, very very sticky for much of the year. Midwinter actually is very pleasant, but usually the skies are leaden and the atmosphere is oppressive and humid. But the British expatriates are very happy there, and they have their clubs. I remember myself playing touch rugby in the rugby club, playing golf, and it's rather a pleasant place unless you're a Shia villager being oppressed by the Bahraini police and never being allowed to have a say in government.
Now, this idea of Shia and Sunni, some have compared it to this whole thing of, the Catholics as the Shia and the Protestants as the Sunni, a sort of, Johnny come lately version of the religion. And of course, there's been conflict between the two, both in that region and here in the UK and other parts of Europe, and other parts of the world. So is that, do you think that's a bit trite to compare this idea of Sunni Shia and Catholic Protestant?
Yes, I think it really is a good way to understand the difference by equating the Shia to the Catholics and the Sunnis to Protestantism. The Shia venerate saints as do Catholics. They go to shrines as do Catholics. They have liturgy, ceremony, as do Catholics, and they have a sort of church leadership of ayatollahs that has no equivalent in Sunni Islam, which is more Puritan, more Methodist or Presbyterian than Church of England. So this is I think a helpful way of understanding, and it's also the equation also works in terms of politics, because as in Ireland, the British ruled over the Catholics, and they brought in Protestant colonists, and that's what's gone on in Bahrain. Effectively, the British did the same, and the sh in the Middle East, the Shia have traditionally been the downtrodden, as in Bahrain, where there's a very large Shia, not just a minority, they are the biggest community in Lebanon, but they are, under the Lebanese constitution, not allowed to have the two top jobs in government, president or prime minister. And this is basically why Hezbollah emerged, to champion the downtrodden Shia masses of Lebanon. And that's the appeal of Iran in much of the Middle East, where there are Shia communities.
So just focusing on Bahrain again, how much damage over the last 6 months or so have the Iranians actually done to Bahrain? Obviously, this is quite it's quite important as to whether it can function as a port, for example, whether they can desalinate the water supply. There are various very important aspects, including, of course, the military presence of Western countries there.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I have a good handle on this, and of course it's a tightly held secret how much damage Iran has inflicted in the Gulf. But I would guess that in the case of Bahrain, it's extremely severe. Bahrain is not a rich country. Bahrain doesn't have significant oil of its own. The only bits of oil it has with gifted to it by the Saudis in a shared a small shared oil field. Bahrain is the poor relation of the Sunni principalities in the Gulf, and literally goes cap in hand around the Gulf, the other Gulf capitals, for money. Their economy was heavily reliant on the US base, on the refinery, on tourism, on shipping, and all these things have come to a virtual halt. I honestly don't know how they are surviving, but no doubt they are receiving subventions from the Saudis, who are almost as afraid as the Bahrainis are themselves of the Shia community taking control of that country. Let's not forget that Eastern Saudi Arabia is similar to Bahrain in demography. The majority of population in the oil-producing regions of Saudi Arabia are Shia. So Saudi will always come to the rescue of Bahrain in the last analysis.
The war seems to have started up again the last 10 days or so, Peter. The memorandum of understanding is floating away in the water, is kind of dissolving actually, so as if it never was. And I just wonder what you make of these exchanges that we're now seeing between Iran and the Gulf states and the United States. And amazingly, Israel is saying we're staying out of this.
Yes, well, there's an unspoken agreement, obviously, between the Iranians and the Israelis not to hit each other, because neither would stand to gain. Iran's beef is currently just with America. It's America, goaded, of course, by the Israelis, which is trying to rewrite the memorandum of understanding that gave, or that conceded, Iranian supremacy in the Straits of Hormuz. And the Americans, in their imperial way, when they got the memorandum of understanding home and they saw what it actually meant, swallowed and said, "We're not having this. We'll go back to bombing the Iranians." The bottom line is that the memorandum of understanding made Trump look bad. And that's his bottom line. He can't come out of this looking bad. There's got to be some fig leaf that will allow him to proclaim, if not victory, at least that he's not been bested. But it's an immovable object and an irresistible force because the Iranians cannot possibly concede control over the Straits of Hormuz, which is their only effective protection. The Americans, by destroying half the Iranian military, have left the Iranians with no choice but to hold on to the cards that they have. And that means retaining their capability to block the straits and not allow the southern passage, more difficult to reach for their missiles, to become an American protected zone. And so this tit for tat may go on for an extended period until the oil price again gets over $100, and the same logic will come back that brought the fighting to an end in the first place and led to the memorandum of understanding. Currently, the price is just north of 90. So we may not be far away from that point. With the difference that world reserve stocks of oil and gas are much lower now than they were at the start of this second Iranian-US war in 2 years. And that works to the advantage of Iran, of course, because the pain will be felt in the world economy sooner.
Well, it works to the advantage of Donald Trump because he and his friends are making a lot of money on this oil price going up and down. But it also, the United States, it works to their advantage because people are having to buy oil from them. They can't buy it from Iran.
Yes, this is true, but nevertheless, the same logic applies now as it did 2 months ago, 6 weeks ago, when the pressure in the world economy became so great that the Americans had to cry uncle. And the same actions will bring about the same results. I don't see any other outcome possible.
Now, the Americans say, whether they're right or not, be interesting to get your view, that actually the memorandum of understanding, which was this ceasefire agreement between Iran and America, was torn up by the Iranians. It was them that first started attacking tankers and ships as they're going through the Straits of Hormuz. And that's why the Americans began to resume this bombardment of Iran.
Well, that's rubbish, of course. This kicked off because the Americans immediately started to try to create a US protected southern route. Let's get the chronology right. It was the Americans who started to escort tankers through a southern route close to the Omani coast. And they did this for obvious reasons to weaken the Iranian negotiating position, and this could not be tolerated. It was a clear breach of the MOU. So let's get the chronology right here. Iran has been responding to an American breach and provocation.
Where do you see this going? This conflict between the United States and obviously Israel are loving it because the Americans are doing their dirty work for them. But where do you see it heading?
Well, I'm moderately optimistic that within a couple of weeks, the Americans will back down. I mean, generally speaking, the more strident the threats from Trump, and the more likely he is to be on the point of backing down. And judging from his language in the last 48 hours, that's the point where we're close to reaching. But let's n not overlook that a new front has just opened up in the last 48 hours, the Red Sea. For slightly separate reasons, because they themselves, the Houthis in Yemen, were attacked by Saudi Arabia, they have announced that they are blocking the Bab al-Mandeb at the mouth of the Red Sea to Saudi shipping or ships going to and from Saudi ports. And according to one report in the course of today, they hit a Saudi tanker. So this again works to Iran's advantage. It shows that they haven't played all their cards. They've been keeping the Houthis in reserve, but the Houthis are clearly up for it. And when goaded, they will react themselves, even without being told to by the Iranians. And all this knocks on the head the stupid stories that have been running about alternative routes and pipelines that would take years and be easy to knock out, and all sorts of other misinformation and disinformation which have been peddled about alternatives to the Strait of Hormuz.
Could you say something about the new government we've got in Britain? It's quite peculiar, isn't it, on the home front that there's been no actual election. There doesn't seem to have been any complaints from the Parliamentary Labour Party nor from the Labour membership that they've had no say in the move from Starmer to. It's almost like a big reshuffle has happened in terms of cabinet positions, including the Prime Minister's being reshuffled. But I wonder whose hands might be behind this. Are they British hands? May they be foreign hands? And what do you make of these new appointments, Peter?
Well, there's been a very British coup, hasn't there? A very British coup, all very gentlemanly and polite, but in the end, brutal. The old regime has gone, not just the Prime Minister, but 11 of his crew, turfed out unceremonially, by a new regime. Had this happened in Russia, we'd have been screaming blue murder. Burnham has no mandate from the population outside Makerfield, and let's not forget that even the voters of Makerfield only voted for him because they wanted to get rid of Starmer, not because they actively wanted Burnham. But he's seen as the savior of Labour, and it's just the Labour Party grandees and movers and shakers inside the Labour Party. At every level of the party, they realized they had to get rid of Starmer because he was going to lose them the next election and possibly even a lot more on the way. And so now they're being given a second chance. You can see them. It's as though they've won the lottery a second time. The clock starts from zero again. They've now got another 3 years to repeat the mistakes that they made in the first 2 years. And no one is going to call them to account. The other parties are weak for different reasons. They may call a general election, but they don't really mean it. And anyway, they don't have the power to make it happen. But that is the British Constitution. The Prime Minister is the head, whoever happens to be the head of the ruling party, the party which can command a majority in the House of Commons. And that's what's happened. It has been a coup. As to the cabinet selections, I have a rather different take from most people. I think Burnham is, it's not the jobs that he's given people, but the jobs he's taken them away from. So taking away Miliband from energy was a bit of a master stroke because he's removed the biggest threat to the British economy, the net zero fanatic who is preventing the development of the North Sea and imposing the massive net zero cost, especially on British industry and consumers. He's now moved from that pivotal position. He's no longer able to destroy the economy, at least not to the same extent. And the woman who's replaced him may be a disciple of Green Ed, but she's a novice. She's only been in Parliament 2 years. She will be easily bullied into quietly toning down the net zero nonsense, which is the only hope that Labour have of restoring some growth into the British economy. If they don't do that, well, the game will be completely up. But I take encouragement from the fact that Miliband has been moved. And secondly, in another cunning move, Burnham has removed John Healey from the back benches, where he would have been a thorn in the side, constantly bleating about more defence spending. And instead, he's been put in a position where he's the one who will have to say no to the new Minister of Defence. And no one will be better placed than John Healey to say no, because he knows where the Ministry of Defence bodies are buried. He knows where the billions have been wasted on obsolete aircraft carriers and APCs and all the rest. I may be guilty of wishful thinking here, but I think Burnham had been rather astute with these two appointments. The other appointments, well, he cut out a lot of dead wood. I mean, who's going, apart from comedians, who is going to lament the departure of David Lammy, or any of the rest of the 11 who've been sacked? That's my take.
Well, John Healey was Defence Secretary. He was one of the first to resign, I think, a month ago or so, maybe a bit more, to sort of, it's almost as if he'd seen the writing on the wall that Starmer was going to go. There was also the fact that the resignation of Starmer as Prime Minister was actually announced about 5 or 6 hours before it was announced in Britain. It was announced by Donald Trump on Truth Social that that Starmer was going, which I found amusing, rather interesting that this is a decision which is announced in America before it's announced in Britain. But the fact is, Healey is very close to NATO. He's very close to the those calling for big expansion of British defence, and it's almost as if he's been rewarded by them saying, well, you have your first dibs in the treasury, in the British coffers now, and go ahead and spend as much as you want on particularly pursuing this war with Russia.
Well, you didn't have to be clairvoyant to foresee that Keir Starmer was the Walking Dead. And Donald Trump isn't a clairvoyant, but anybody could have seen his that Starmer's departure was imminent. I think it was fairly simple. As I described earlier, the Labour Party is just clutching at straws. It brought in this virtual unknown, a new great white hope, who talks the talk and who has some political acumen. I mean, his early days have been he's been rather clever, avoiding questions, and coming up with one or two populist initiatives, one or two things, stealing the clothes from the Labour left. People like ourselves in the Workers' Party, we too are anti-net zero, and the opening up of the North Sea is a move that we can only welcome, although it's not enough. The dropping of apparent dropping of digital ID is another move which will be popular, and represent the listening to the base. There was no clamour for it. Labour was only getting brickbats for it. And also earlier, a couple of weeks ago, didn't Burnham come out with an apology over Gaza and the way Labour had, in the early days of the Gaza war, had refused to accept what was really going on? So these three concrete actions show, in the parlance of the Daily Mail, a lurch to the left, which can only satisfy most of the Labour Party and actually most of the population. They go in the right direction. But now comes the difficult bit. Now comes the nitty-gritty hard decisions. And on Friday, note this, breaking news, there is going to be such a decision required, because at the International Criminal Court, there will be a vote of the 125 members of the court, and that includes the UK, a vote on what? On whether the chief prosecutor, who leveled charges of genocide against Netanyahu and his defense minister, whether this guy by the name of Karim Khan, who is a British lawyer, should be sacked on trumped up charges about alleged sexual misconduct. Well, the International Criminal Court did an investigation, and back in March, three judges chosen by the ICC concluded that there was no case to answer. The evidence didn't amount to finding that there had been misconduct. But nevertheless, the Americans have engineered a situation at the ICC where there has to be a political trial and a vote on Friday, and Britain will have to stand up and be counted. Are they going to vote with genocide, with Israel, with Trump? Or are they going to stand up for the ICC, for the judge, and for doing what is morally right in international law? So we will see how much Burnham's posturing on Gaza is actually worth when push comes to shove, and there'll be no escape. An abstention will be an act of abject cowardice. Britain and the Workers' Party have put out a statement today calling on Burnham to stand up for Judge Khan and defend him against these charges.
Finally, Peter, a couple of incidents on the day that Andy Burnham takes up his job as Prime Minister, and you could see it as coincidence or it could be interesting timing. One is the Russians doing live firing exercises in international waters in the west of the English Channel. And the other one is the Elon Musk and his Twitter ex people actually suspending the account of the British consulate in Jerusalem for tweeting various messages about human rights for Palestinians in the West Bank, which are being violated by the Israelis. I wonder, do you think they may be connected with either of these, or both, or neither might be connected with Burnham's arrival?
No, I don't. These things have been brewing for weeks. I don't think there's anything at all to do with the advent of Burnham. I mean, the situation in the Channel and situation between Britain and Russia hasn't seen any change, even from the days when there was a Tory government, and it's not going to be any different under Burnham. He hasn't given any signal that he's going to follow a different line, and we're going to see the same nonsense, the same goading of Russia, which only results in goading by Russia because they cannot allow themselves to be bossed around or appear to be intimidated. That's what happens when you get into a situation like this, which can only remind us of the lead up to the First World War that nobody wanted, but one thing leads to another until in the end you've toppled over the edge of the precipice, and that's the direction in which we seem to be headed. The British consulate has been pumping out good stuff about what's going on in the West Bank for a long, long time. Well done to them for getting themselves suspended by Twitter. It shows that they were having an impact.
Okay, Peter Ford, from the Workers' Party and former ambassador to Bahrain, Syria, and I don't know, I don't know how many other countries, Peter. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Tony. Thank you for having me.